since this is supposedly in part the war to force regime change, that the very first regime change we might see is that of Tony Blair in Great Britain.
I would almost venture to say that any of the unions that have large numbers of people of color in their ranks are going to be against this war.
When the United States claims to be going to war against Iraq to enhance the credibility of the United Nations, the rest of the world properly understands that as a joke.
Bush can, of course, say that he'll go ahead anyway, but in turn we'll face now extreme reluctance on the part of the American people and skepticism about going it alone.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, March 12, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Pakistani and U.S. officials are denying Iran Radio's report that bin Laden has been arrested in Pakistan, but that his capture would not be announced until the outbreak of fighting in Iraq. The Iranian state radio's external service quoted the deputy leader of the Islamic Awami Tariq Party in Pakistan, who also made the same assertion to the Associated Press. Pakistani Interior and Information Ministries denied that Osama bin Laden had been captured, as did the CIA and the U.S. military in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the diplomatic impasse over invading Iraq continues. The six swing states on the U.N. Security Council that represent the key to a U.S. victory have proposed a 45-day reprieve for Iraq. The Bush administration was dismissive of the proposal, calling it a, quote, non-starter. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said, quote, on this matter, the American people are becoming increasingly impatient with the U.N. A vote on a second British-American resolution imposing a March 17th deadline was delayed yesterday when it became clear the nine votes needed were not secured. As the United States prepared to press the U.N. Security Council into a vote on war with Iraq before the end of the week, Washington was looking increasingly isolated on the world stage and may even have to gear up for an assault on Baghdad without the military backup of its staunchest ally, Britain. Responding to reporters' questions at a press briefing yesterday, Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld acknowledged for the first time that mounting pressure against Tony Blair in Britain may force the U.S. to go it alone.
Support for a possible war is shrinking rapidly in Great Britain. Two questions. Would the United States go to war without Great Britain? And two, would the role of the British in an initial assault be scaled back?
This is a matter that the most of the senior officials in the government discuss with the UK on a daily or every other day basis. And I had a good visit with the Minister of Defense of the UK about an hour ago. Their situation is distinctive to their country, and they have a government that deals with a parliament in their way, distinctive way. And what will ultimately be decided is unclear as to their role. That is to say, their role in the event a decision is made to use force. There's the second issue of their role in a post-Saddam Hussein reconstruction process or stabilization process, which would be a different matter. And I think until we know what the resolution is, we won't know the answer as to what their role will be. And to the extent they are able to participate in the event that the president decides to use force, that would obviously be welcomed. To the extent they're not, there are workarounds, and they would not be involved, at least in that phase of it.
We would consider going to war without our closest ally then.
That is an issue that the president will be addressing in the days ahead, one would assume.
Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld. David Eisenberg is a senior analyst with the British American Security Information Council. During an interview earlier today with Peace Watch, we asked Eisenberg how Rumsfeld's statement is playing on Downing Street.
Well, I think it caused a bit of consternation, perhaps even momentary panic, although I think some of the reaction was overstated. I actually think the explanation that seems most likely is that Secretary Rumsfeld, who's usually a fairly articulate man, was trying to emphasize that he understood the political pressures that Prime Minister Blair was under and was trying to indicate that they did not take the support of the British government or the likelihood of its fighting alongside American forces for granted And in that sense, he was trying to show, I suppose, his sensitivity toward that. Unfortunately, he used a poor choice of words to indicate it.
And indeed, the political pressures are on. There are reports that 40 Labor MPs called for Blair to step aside. At this point, how likely is it that Blair will back down from his position?
I don't think Prime Minister Blair will back down from his position at all in terms of saying, i.e., that Saddam Hussein must comply with the disarmament obligations and also that the British military, if an invasion comes, will fight alongside with the forces of the U.S. military. That being said, I think it's quite likely and increasingly probable that he will seek to go the extra mile to get some political breathing room. He will move heaven and earth to try and get a resolution through the Security Council. That means trying to push President Bush to grant yet more time. I think he is doing that, although how much more time he can get is an open question. I think increasingly the Bush administration is feeling that the sheer logistics of keeping forces in the region set their own timetable.
It appears that Tony Blair's political life is on the line here. Is that an overstatement?
No, I don't think so. I kind of quip, but only partially tongue-in-cheek, that since this is supposedly in part a war to force regime change, that the very first regime change we might see is that of Tony Blair in Great Britain before we see Saddam Hussein out of Iraq.
Rumsfeld said that until we know what the resolution is, we won't know what Britain's role will be and to the extent they'll be able to participate. Is it possible that Britain could pull back its troops but support the impending invasion in other ways? Do you think the Parliament would sign on to something, a lesser commitment of that nature?
Well, the other things that they might do, they've been doing all along in terms of providing access for U.S. Material and troops transiting through bases in Great Britain, allowing U.S. Planes in Great Britain to go to the Persian Gulf Theater, etc. I think basically Great Britain has two choices with respect to its troops. It either fights along with the U.S. or it says, and it's inconceivable to me that it would do this, is say, you know, we no longer support your position and we are not going to fight alongside you. I think for the reasons I stated, Prime Minister Blair is not going to say that. So I don't think, they would do anything less than stay and either fight with the U.S. or by some other circumstance war is averted, then they would pull their troops out, presumably along with the same time at the United States. I should say one other thing. You know, it is a disservice to Great Britain to talk about being able to fight without them, because there's more to a war than just fighting to overthrow Saddam Hussein. There is the whole issue of what happens after that, post-war reconstruction or occupation. The British have already said, you know, we understand there will need to be a commitment of time made here, and they've stated that they're willing to be in there for the long haul, and they're talking 3, 4, maybe 5 years. That's a very big commitment. Even the United States has not said that it's willing to keep its troops in Iraq for that period of time. It would be a huge liability to sort of alienate another country who's willing to do that sort of thing and make that sort of commitment. In that sense, Secretary Rumsfeld's remarks were ill-chosen.
So are you saying that Britain actually wants to be, they're offended because they won't have an opportunity to participate in this sort of an occupying force in that country for 3 to 5 years afterwards?
No, I'm not saying they're offended. I'm saying that it's poor policy. If you really intend to live up to your words in terms of trying to create a government free of fear, free of despotism, free of tyranny, no dictators, a representative proportional form of government, it's going to take a lot of work and effort. Security is going to be a part of that. It's very foolish and arrogant to assume that one country can do it all, can do it by itself. You need all the help you can get. You should welcome those countries who are willing to put in a commensurate effort of men and time, etc., and funding to do that. The Brits are the only country, really, who have said that they are willing to do that. To that extent, it's very poor. Again, if you're serious about living up to your words about what you want to see happen in Iraq, to do things and say things which would alienate that country, willing to make that kind of commitment.
David Eisenberg is a senior analyst with the British American Security Information Council. U.S. Congressman Jim Moran of Virginia recently came under fire for comments regarding Jewish support for the war in Iraq. Peace Watch spoke with political analyst Chris Tunsing of the Middle East Research and Information Project about Moran's comments and whether or not he felt Moran's comments were accurate and whether there was a connection between the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and Iraq.
I don't think that that's the single causation for the rush to war on the part of the Bush administration. Where perhaps Representative Moran is confused is that there are some very prominent members of the administration, neoconservative intellectuals who are located in the vice president's office in the Defense Department, who have been, some of them are Jewish, and they have been pushing for war in Iraq to remove Saddam Hussein since long before they were in office in the Bush administration.
Would that be Richard Perle?
Richard Perle is the most visible of these figures. The most powerful of these figures is probably Paul Wolfowitz, who's the Deputy Secretary of Defense. And there would also be Louis Libby in the Vice President's office, Douglas Feith, who's also in the Defense Department. And, you know, these figures have long been pushing for war in Iraq. And they've also long been associated with the Israeli right and with the strategic vision of the Israeli right for the Middle East. And it's not a coincidence that the Israeli right, their line has long been, the road to Jerusalem leads through Baghdad. And that's a line that Wolfowitz and so on have taken up here domestically. But there's a real confluence of interests in the Bush administration that has converged to make war in Iraq at the top of the foreign policy agenda. So I don't think that it's fair.
You say the Jewish neoconservatives.
Yes, and not all people who would be described as neoconservatives are Jewish. A very prominent neoconservative is Afghan, Zalmay Khalilzad, who is the administration's envoy to free Iraqis, as they call them, and also is the envoy of the administration to Afghanistan in the post-Taliban era. He is also associated with this trend of thinking. And the thinking is essentially based on Reaganite ideas about the role of the United States in the world. It's based on a very, they would say, a muscular foreign policy, which is very unapologetic about the use of U.S. military power to bolster its political and economic hegemony. This set of ideas really arose in the wake of at the end of the Cold War, when people were casting about for a justification for the United States to remain the sole superpower, and also ways to make sure that the United States remained the sole superpower. And so, you know, it was Wolfowitz and, well, he was working for Cheney as defense secretary under the first Bush, who came up with the ideas that have been crystallized in the national security strategy of the current Bush administration. Namely, the idea that the U.S. should use its military force to preempt the rise of a global challenger, like the Soviet Union used to be, that will rival the United States on the global stage. And so that idea is, it does have congruence with support for the Israeli right. But it's the reason why it's so powerful in Washington and in this administration is that it leverages the power of the Pentagon, it leverages the power of the defense hawks like Cheney and Rumsfeld, who really don't care about Israel in the final analysis. You know, so it's this real confluence of interests. And the reason why the neoconservatives are so influential is that they completely share this vision of a strong American hyperpower.
In fact, others have said that members of the Bush administration have been pushing for Israel to be a kind of surrogate power for the U.S. in the region.
And that, of course, predates this administration. During the Cold War, one of the bases for the strong relationship between the United States and Israel was that the United States saw Israel as a bulwark against the spread of communism and also against the spread of Arab nationalism. So, you know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, for those thinkers in the United States who always want to have a global enemy, you know, the what arose to take the place of world communism has been Islam or radical Islam. And so it's also been possible to portray Israel as a bulwark against the spread of radical Islam in the Middle East, where, of course, there's a very important strategic resource for the United States in Persian Gulf oil.
Mm-hmm. It's said that the emphasis on Iraq is perhaps a cover for Israel to continue its encroachment of Palestinian lands that they're occupying in the West Bank. Many people are concerned about the Israel factor in the war or the impending war with Iraq. Is it possible that Israel is sort of the elephant in the living room about which no one is talking?
I think yes and no. Israel is the elephant in the living room in the sense that there is no question that both former Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Ariel Sharon have written op-eds in major U.S. press. Barak had his in the Post, and Sharon had his in the New York Times. And this was back this past summer, and they were calling for the United States to invade Iraq. I don't think it's a secret that the current Israeli government is cheering this development. They very much are pleased that the United States is prepared to go to war to remove Saddam Hussein from power. So it is the elephant in the living room in the sense that if people want to deny that the government of Israel has been cheering this development and that supporters of the government in Israel who are influential in the Bush administration have been pushing this development forward, then that's not true. But it's not as if this is the real cause for the war in Iraq and that it has been kept purposely out of public view so as to avoid criticizing Israel. Frankly, I think a major concern for the U.S. moving forward here is that the current government of Israel will exploit a wartime situation to intensify its repression of the Palestinians. And while this administration is probably not going to do much about that, they've shown that they will not intervene even as weakly as the United States has done in the past, to ameliorate that. But I think the administration would find themselves in a very tight spot indeed if there were to be expulsions of Palestinians from the Palestinian territories sort of under the cover of the war. And that is one dangerous possibility, since there are, of course, parties in the current Israeli government which do advocate mm-hmm. expulsion of Palestinians as part of their political platform.
So, in other words, as the world is transfixed on Iraq, Israel uses this opportunity to further its agenda against the Palestinians.
Right. And I think I think that's undoubted, that is what's going on. And that's, I'm sure, how the Sharon government sees it.
And so how do we separate this political assessment from statements such as the one that Representative Moran made about the Jewish community?
There are many, many gradations within the American Jewish community.
I guess we should say pro-Israel Jews.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That has always been the term that I've preferred because it's more accurate. A very important component of the pro-Israel lobby in today's United States is the Christian right. And if you want to understand why the Bush administration has converged so much with the views of Sharon, then I think you really need to look at the power of the Christian right in the Bush administration and also with W himself, who is clearly an evangelical Christian himself. Many American Jews are not supporters of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. They support a two-state solution, which would mean ending the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. So, it's much more complicated than saying that the Jewish community is behind the war.
But we see how anyone who broaches this discussion, anyone of a high political profile or in a position to have influence, they tend to have to serve a very heavy political price. We see here where Representative Moran has had to apologize. And I think that in and of itself, because of the power of the pro-Israel lobby, does not really serve the overall Jewish community well.
I think that's true. I think Moran's mistake was to use the term Jewish community and not to make any distinction whatsoever. But it has to be said that there are elements in the American Jewish community and in the pro-Israel lobby who are not Jewish, like the Christian right, who will raise the charge of anti-Semitism any time that any policy of the government of Israel is criticized. And it's true that whenever the American Jewish community or other pro-Israel people criticize or raise the charge of anti-Semitism, they are feeding into that inability of the American public to make distinctions that they should make.
And in the international arena, the U.S. has continually touted the fact that Iraq has not complied with U.N. resolutions. Recently, someone did a count of other countries that failed to comply and found that Israel has not complied with as many as 32 different U.N. resolutions, and it seems to be that there is a double standard for Israel.
Indeed, there is. And, of course, the United States has been the main reason why Israel has not had to comply with those UN resolutions. There is an international consensus otherwise that Israel should comply. There are other countries, all of which coincidentally happen to be in the Middle East, that the United States does protect either with its veto or by simply refusing to pressure those governments to comply with the resolutions. So yes, there is definitely a double standard when the United States claims to be going to war against Iraq to enhance the credibility of the United Nations. The rest of the world properly understands that as a joke.
So what impact does this have on the credibility of the U.S. as a world leader?
Indeed, that's the question.
Chris Tensing, editor of Middle East Report, a project of the Middle East Research and Information Project. Is it anti-Semitic to link the war against Iraq and Israel? A weekly columnist for the UK independent newspaper, Yasmin Alibi Brown, has been engaged in a battle of words for a series of articles she wrote linking Israel to an impending war on Iraq. Peace Watch spoke with her yesterday about her articles and the differences between the U.S. policy in Iraq and Israel.
I certainly think that you can't discuss what we're doing to Iraq without then trying to explain why we're not doing anything about Israel. And it's not just a position. If you're going to have an honest discussion, that central question remains to be answered. Why do we insist, and maybe, you know, it is right to insist, although I don't believe in the war, that Iraq should, you know, deliver what it has been asked to deliver for years. Why do we then not ask anything of Israel? Now, I'm one of those Muslims who's always accepted Israel's right to exist. I've never, ever denied that. And I'm, you know, extremely worried about anti-Semitism, including in myself. You know, I constantly question myself whether, you know, whether I'm actually getting more anti-Semitic. I'm very worried about that. But I still think you can't discuss the two. You know, you can't discuss the one without dragging in the other.
Well, at the same time, others may say, well, Israel doesn't pose a threat to the U.S.
Well, no, Israel doesn't pose a threat to the U.S., but Israel poses a huge threat to many people in the area. We don't know. I mean, one of my columns said, we know exactly what weapons the other Arab countries have, because A, they're mostly corrupt potentates, and B, we've sold them the weapons, so we know exactly what they've got. We have no idea what Israel's got ever since 1966, when John Kennedy sent a mission to find out, and they hid most of the stuff from him. He was killed a few months, you know, a while later, and there's never been any audit of the weapons of mass destruction that Israel has. And under its present leadership, how can anybody trust what Israel is going to do?
A U.S. congressman, according to the Washington Post last week, Congressman Jim Moran, in responding to a question about the war in Iraq, said, quote, if it were not for the strong support of the Jewish community for this war with Iraq, we would not be doing this, unquote. And he's come under heavy fire for his comments.
Yes, I've got this. Somebody emailed me. But also Joe Klein said that, and it was quoted in, he wrote that in Time magazine about the second week of February.
Do you feel the statement is true?
Inextricably tied with what we're doing in Iraq.
Do you feel the statement is true?
Of course, it's patently true.
Is it possible that there needs to be a distinction made, perhaps, between saying the Jewish community and saying pro-Israel Jews?
I don't even think it is just about Israel and Jewish people in general. I do think it's about the present government of Israel. I think we have to be very, you know, very specific. Under the present government, under Sharon, we are getting something we haven't seen for a long time. And we have to be very specific and be free to criticize that without people accusing us of being, you know, anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. I think it's almost a deliberate way of derailing proper criticism. And I no longer accept that.
Of course, in your article, you write that, and then there's the Holocaust argument, which is always valid. You want to expound on that?
Well, I think that there is a very, I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what it feels like to be a descendant of a people who went through what European Jews went through. And I would never, ever claim that I understand it, or we should put it aside, or that it's no longer relevant. It will always be relevant, and I hope we always keep it alive, together with all the other injustices that we've seen in the world around us. But it cannot be that a people who have suffered that injustice cannot see the connection between what happened to them and what the present government of Israel is doing in their name. I think it's a terrible betrayal of that memory.
Yasmin Alibi Brown, a weekly columnist for the Independent newspaper of Great Britain. Turkish soldiers fired in the air today, and demonstrators tried to block what they call the illegal deployment of U.S. troops onto Turkish soil. Around 150 Turkish demonstrators tried to force their way through the gates of the Mediterranean port of the Iskenderun, but were rebuffed by fire from the Turkish army. The protesters shouted, "Yankee, go home," as blue-uniformed Turkish police and troops in camouflage uniforms and helmets blocked their way. More than 90% of Turks opposed the war. Just 12 days ago, March 1st, the Turkish parliament voted not to allow the U.S.-led war on Iraq. Nonetheless, U.S. military convoys leave every day from the port of Iskenderun for the Turkish-Iraqi border. Meanwhile, the European Court for Human Rights censored Turkey for its treatment of Kurdish PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan. From Diyarbakir, Turkey, Aaron Glantz has the story.
Mustafa Karahan addresses a crowd of hundreds in front of the Diyarbakir offices of DEHAP, the largest Kurdish political party in Turkey. The head of the party's office notes American forces continue to arrive in Turkey every day, despite the fact that the parliament voted last Saturday to deny U.S. troops the right to launch a war on Iraq from Turkish soil. Many of the U.S. troops entering Turkey are bound for Mardin, only a few miles away from here. Tens of thousands of Turkish soldiers have also re-entered the region, saying they're trying to secure the border with Iraq ahead of a possible war. But the military buildup is ominous for the people here. It comes only a few months after the lifting of the OHAL, or state of emergency. And today, people have turned out to protest not only the war, but also police repression of Kurdish people, especially imprisoned Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan. Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the illegal Kurdish militia, the PKK, or KADEK as it's now known, was arrested in Kenya and now serves in prison on his own island in the Mediterranean Ocean. For 15 weeks, he has been in isolation. His lawyers and his family have been unable to see him. Today, the European Court for Human Rights ruled Öcalan's isolation humane, but it also ruled his 1999 trial illegal by international standards because a military judge sat in during the courtroom proceedings. The court ordered a new trial and payment of more than $100,000 to cover the Kurdish leader's court costs. Shabe is a 48-year-old housewife.
We haven't seen Abdullah for 13 to 14 weeks. The lawyers can't see him. His family can't see him. We're anxious for his life. Let them see him. He is the leader of the Kurdish nation. Let all the world know about this. Please.
The demonstration didn't last long. Only a few minutes after it started, a phalanx of riot police armed with M16 automatic rifles charged the crowd, which dispersed. An armed personnel carrier idled close by. Tens of thousands of Turkish army troops have entered southeastern Anatolia since George Bush started talking about war on Iraq. And entire sections of the region are now part of a closed military zone. Thousands more Turkish troops have crossed into northern Iraq, with the stated mission of preventing a Kurdish state. This worker turned out at the rally in front of the DEHAP office.
Turkey is a ship. If the ship sinks, we all sink, Kurds and Turks. So we have to love each other and cooperate more now than at any other time. Leader Abdullah Öcalan has been silenced for more than 4 months. This action has silenced the entire Kurdish nation, not just an individual. The silence cannot be measured. for he symbolizes Turkey's 40 million Kurdish people.
The president of the Diyarbakir branch of DEHAP, Mustafa Karahan, has a more moderate view, calling on the international community for help.
We believe that Abdullah Öcalan has to be judged again, but this re-judgment must be in an international court which sees both sides. It is through that 35,000 people have died in the Kurdish-Turkish civil war. The people responsible for this are not from one side only. They are from both sides, and both sides have to be judged in an international court.
It's unlikely the Turkish government will allow itself to be judged in an international court, but Karahan says the Kurdish people will continue working for their democratic rights until they win. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz with Özlem Sarıyıldız in Diyarbakır, southeastern Turkey.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.